A podcast of the cinema, and you're stealing my water.
I don't care. Experimenting with 5-4 microphones again.
Yeah, this is Alonzo Duraldi.
Dave White.
And we're going to sound a little weird in this episode because we gave the good mics to our guests because, frankly, they deserve them. This is our annual year in review episode, and we have our wonderful annual year in review panel back with us. Robert Abley from The Wrap and the LA Times.
Hello. Hello.
Peter DeBruge from Variety.
Thank you.
And Manola Dargis from The New York Times.
Nothing but fun.
So, you know, I had a whole bunch of different topics to talk about, but, you know, last night the Producers Guild gave Best Picture of 2018 to Green Book. So I guess that's where we start. What the hell?
This is a grief session.
We're processing. I mean, it's just insane, not only in the fact that, like, you know, when I carved my list of movies that I loved last year down to 25, which was already insane, like, Green Book was never in the conversation. And also... Now this is going to be the movie that's emblematic of the year that gave us If Beale Street Could Talk and, you know, Black Klansman and Sorry to Bother You and Blindspotting and all these films that are sort of tackling race in an interesting way. This is the movie that is tackling race in the same old-fashioned Hollywood phony way.
It's like a movie that was unearthed from the 80s and released now. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I would even argue that Peter Farrelly, when he made movies with his brother, made more interesting and more enjoyable movies about the diversity of humanity in, like, movies like Stuck on You and, like, where, like, the sense of camaraderie of everybody, you know, it was much more interesting and enjoyable than in Green Book.
Well, he wasn't pointing arrows at his themes in those movies.
Exactly.
He's always been a champion of inclusion,
right,
and sort of laughing along with, rather than kind of patronizing, but this just feels so safe.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's much worse than safe. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's a movie. I saw it in a movie theater on the west side of Los Angeles, and unsurprisingly, perhaps, most of the people in the audience seem to be white, just casual glance around. And they loved it.
What age demo are we talking about?
I was there with you, I think.
Yeah, older than us.
Yeah,
I'm middle aged, barely. yeah, I'm in the later part of my middle. But it, you know, people were very.
They were laughing at all the right.
They were
moments.
Laughing at all the right moments,
and
there was one couple that was seated in front of us. Robert, we actually were applauding. I mean, they were just so happy, and you realize that the movie is giving a certain white moviegoer a vision that they can really, and, you know, feel good about themselves because
right.
It's saying, oh, no, you're not, you know, don't worry about your own racism. You know, you don't have to interrogate or think about your own racism. Look at this white person who we all know is racist on screen, played by the Viggo Mortensen character, who's a chauffeur. We understand, and watch how he can change. You know, it's really a white redemption story.
Oh, totally, yeah.
You know?
And it's that whole thing of the help where racism isn't this systemic, baked-in part of the American democracy. It is a thing that certain mean people decide to adopt, but then they can be fixed.
Right, so it's just an individual problem that you have to... It's a kind of, you know, it's an extension of the bootstraps idea. You know, we just need to, like, see past our differences, you know, as opposed to any sort of institutional racism. And which is really, you know, particularly rich coming from the American movie industry, which of course is incredibly racist, and incredibly sexist, and has been for its entirety of its history. So
yeah, no, it's like it treats racism as something like to be tidied up. You know, it's like, you know, once it's, you know, you can sweep it away, and then everything's, you know, clean
just
and
shiny share,
again.
Just share some fried chicken.
Exactly.
Have a white man explain to a black man how to. I mean, it's. I have no words, you know?
Listen, but I think there is a you have to start somewhere thing to all of these conversations. And so, like, I mean, this movie is nowhere near enough, but it is something. I mean, like...
How many times do we have to start this conversation? I feel like we started over and over again, and we never get past the starting.
Every day with every person. It's like, I mean, not everyone has seen as many movies as we have, or does see, or is able to even engage with the kind of sophisticated argument that we need for them to be looking at.
But,
you know?
But in 2018, we're seeing a movie that seems, you know, that Driving Miss Daisy or
seems
Mrs.
Retrograde.
You know, I mean, because it
guess
is.
Guess Who's Coming to
it
Dinner.
It's not... It's not, you know, it's empirically retrograde. I'm sorry. It's just not question.
It has one or two scenes that do, like, address things that don't typically get addressed in these types of movies. But again, it just falls into that whole, like, we addressed this now in this scene, so now it's been taken care of.
Oh, like the gay thing, for instance?
Or, yeah, or like just, you know, right. It's just...
Yeah, none of those audience members you discussed went, you know, to a different theater in a different neighborhood to experience this in a different way, you know, or ever would afterwards.
Well, the movie is very comforting for a certain mindset, I think.
No,
you
know? And people I know with taste like this movie. It's like, they just... You know, I'm shocked when I hear it, but it's like there are people that like this movie that normally like all the quote unquote right kind of movies. I mean, or whatever you want to say. It's it obviously has some sort of reach.
In our house, we call that stepmomming, because at the end of Stepmom, when Susan Sarandon is dying on Christmas, and she has two goodbye scenes with one with each kid. And she delivers a handmade quilt to each child. You begin to cry. And the film has not earned any of that. It's just that she's dying. And it's Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it's Susan Sarandon. And she loves her children. And she's saying goodbye to them. And she made them a quilt. And you start crying.
I'm kind of tearing up right now.
At the end of this film, it's Christmas. And it's cozy inside the apartment. And they're having the Feast of the Seven Fishes. And Linda Cardellini... is the best mom in the world and the best wife in the world, and is the only like thing worth watching in this entire movie. And she welcomes in this man from the cold, and the Christmas carols are on the stereo, and everybody hugs. The end. It's like this last 5 minutes are not about the film at all.
Oh,
they're about
not.
This.
Agreed.
They're about this thing to make you feel.
It's the group
hug. But also,
oh, it's Christmas.
Think about what
and that's what's happening. So there's that. The other thing is this film tells a giant lie about queerness.
Oh my
god!
Well,
of course.
And the minute he catches Mahershala Ali gets caught in the YMCA with the dude, and Viggo Mortensen's like, "I work in show business. I see this kind of thing all the time." I'm like, "I was born in 1964, 2 years after this film is set, and my father used to call gay people fruits."
Right.
And that's what Viggo Mortensen would have called him too. Mm-hmm. And if he's super racist, he's not going to be out like leading the first brick at Stonewall. Right. And that's kind of what this movie suggests. Like, oh yeah, he's so evolved.
Yeah, he's the super woke 1960s Catholic, you know, legendarily pro-gay. You know?
But by the way, the thing about the ending, you mentioned the ending. It's like the message that end sends, where it's the black man who has to go to the white person's house to make the overture. It really is like, I mean, that's like, that is the message they're sending ultimately, is that even though it's supposedly about this white person, you know, becoming, you know, changing, it's the black person who goes to the white person's house to say, like, please let me in.
Well, I think
guess who's coming to dinner again?
Guess who's coming to Christmas dinner? Well, yeah, Glenn Kenny was saying that the sort of underlying thing of all these movies is that people of color only exist at the pleasure of white people, and that these stories also only exist when white people decide they're going to make them, and that's the only time that they matter.
I think one of the things that complicates all this too is there are two things for me that complicate it. One, that I think that a certain kind of mainstream movie really has a difficult time with real artists, you know. So one of the things I thought about this movie is that it cannot in any way conceive of the Don Shirley character, because he's too far out in a way. Like, the kind of work that he is doing is not really within the vernacular of a filmmaker like Farrelly. You know, it's like, it's so he's kind of exotic also, not just in terms of him being a gay black man, a closeted gay black man in, you know, in the 1960s, but that he makes art that is like, what's that crazy sound he's making? So he can't do that. And the other thing that I think American mainstream movies have difficulty with, and so I'm not taking Farrelly off the hook here, I'm just saying that just this is interesting to me. It just like complicates it.
Of a larger problem.
Yeah, is that it really has a hard time with the life of the mind, you know? And I think that Shirley was, you know, he was an intellectual. He was, you know, there's just, he is too foreign in so many ways. And then I think also just the fact of his art is really foreign, that he can't conceive of him. And the movie doesn't even pretend to understand it. The movie's way in is to give us an Italian-American cartoon. And I'm surprised more Italian Americans haven't taken issue with this, like, bada bing, bada boom.
I'm folding a pizza and eating the whole thing.
I love Viggo Mortensen, but this is just, wince-worthy performance.
I mean, I was a little surprised. I didn't know. I knew Peter Farrelly, obviously, was white. I knew the guy who, one of the other screenwriters, was white because it was, you know, the descendant. But, I mean, like, I was, like, shocked that they were all white because, like, I mean, even Blazing Saddles, I mean, Mel Brooks asked Richard Pryor to be involved in the writing of a movie about, you know, about a comedy about a black sheriff. It's like, why could they not just, like, think, like, why don't we make this movie a little bit more complicated about it, that these two people... I mean, this relationship.
All those screenwriters of Black Klansmen are white, though. I mean, it's an ongoing, based on a book
written by a black author. True. I would just like to say,
you know, Spike is
and straight out of Compton
was
written by
white
guys
too. I would think. I mean,
but to go back to what you were saying about how the movie doesn't really know how to treat this sort of, you know, intellectual artist object, you know, Mark Harris had that piece where he talked about the what makes these movies so appealing to white people is that the black character always also has to learn something. Like, yes,
absolutely.
the white character learns not to be racist, but the black character learns not to be such an ivory tower pointy head and enjoy, you know, Aretha Franklin and fried chicken, you know. Mm. Yeah. And then that way they feel like you're not scolding white people because we've all got something to learn here.
Well, I mean, he had to be taught civil rights. He had to be taught how to eat fried chicken. I mean, it was just unbelievable because the real Don Shirley, like, was knew Martin Luther King. I mean, he was a part of the civil rights movement, but they take all that away because it doesn't help their narrative.
Since this episode is about the best of 2018,
should we shift off from Green Book?
Let's talk about what's good.
Sorry, we just had to kind of process that because of the Producers Guild, which is often just an index often of what wins at the Academy.
Yeah,
and
because
we're just,
the Oscars are going to give us a November 2016 moment.
Totally, yeah. And in fact, I mean, and the only upside of the fact that this movie is becoming such an Oscar behemoth is that I guess they'll nominate Linda Cardellini, who is the one good thing in the movie. But, you know...
Ugh. I think Viggo and Mahershala are good in the movie. It's just that you enjoy watching them as actors. It's just that...
Mahershala is good. I agree with Manola about Viggo. I think it's too much.
I mean, I think he's giving the performance that he's meant to give.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I just think it's a wince-worthy performance.
It's like
Marissa
Tomei and My Cousin Vinny or something. You know, it's
That's
a comedic performance.
It's a comedic performance in a film that knows how to accommodate it. And this one is just sort of like...
It's acknowledging a history of a certain kind of comedic performance, I think that Marissa Tomei won.
But yes, you're right. Let's talk about the upside of 2018. you know, I think...
and all the wonderful black movies that we're going on.
Well, no, I mean, I think that this was an interesting year in terms of, like I said, there were you know, these films from black filmmakers about various facets of the black experience that were interesting. I also thought that for the things that Hollywood is supposed to know how to do and often doesn't, they were getting a lot of that right, too. Like, we had, you know, some of the best superhero movies this year with Black Panther and Into the Spider-Verse. You know, you had really solid comedies like Game Night, and, you know, you had movies like A Simple Favor, which were smart and, you know, maybe better than you thought they were going to be and had something going on under the hood. And so... Again, that's why I find it hilarious that award season has been about Bohemian Rhapsody and Green Book. It's like, wait, no, but all these other movies, what's going on?
It was a great year. I mean, I think, you know, we could all say it was absolutely a great year. And, I mean, the fact that a black and white movie in Spanish set in Mexico in the, you know, what year is it?
71. Spanish and Mixteca.
Exactly, excuse me. And also languages, as it says in brackets, indigenous language. And I'm talking about Roma. The fact that that could actually be something that people, you know, really people saw and were filling theaters, because Netflix actually, part of its strategy was actually to open this in theaters.
See, they listened to you on the show last year where you complained that Netflix wasn't opening their movies.
It was extraordinary, actually. Yeah. You know, so that was just one of many great movies last year. I mean, I think it was
Netflix
a great year.
Of it all was extraordinary last year. Because, like, last year, I mean, I think that if you'd asked me to make a top 10 of Netflix movies, I would have run out of titles at 2. Basically, you know, and it's like, and this year, I mean, I love that you said that, you know, you were kind of like culling your 25, because I was totally in that same position. And, you know, so many of the movies I love didn't make my 10 when we're obliged to make 10s. But it's like, you know, but I've got others that I adore just outside the gates, you know. I mean, for me, Roma falls in that position, and We the Animals and all these things. But like, But Netflix, I was able to do a top 10 of Netflix movies.
Really?
And, right. you know, like...
What the, were they?
I mean, seriously, you've got Roma. You know, I included Annihilation. You've got this great movie,
Happy as Lazaro.
You know, it's Mowgli. Like, yeah. I mean, I didn't even have like
I like Mowgli.
I didn't even have room for Private Life. I ran out of space before then. You've got Private Buster Scruggs. Yeah. You've got
Alex,
you know,
Strangelove.
22 July. You've got the Orson Welles documentary and
the feature
the film. Yeah. I mean, it's like the you've got To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is a terrific John Hughesian kind of rom-com, you know, from a different point of view. It's like,
they paid a lot of money to buy some movies.
Yeah, and they also paid a lot of money to make movies with auteurs who I think are attracted to the idea that they essentially get final cut, a la, you know, Paul Greengrass, a la the Coen brothers, you know. Like,
Neither of those are on my top 30.
Maybe not, but it's like, you know, they are making those movies at Netflix that wouldn't or couldn't get made, you know, kind of elsewhere. And, I mean, like, Roma is that, you know.
Roma was not produced by Netflix.
Right, it's a movie that they bought.
It was financed, right.
Having seen 15 minutes of it, you know, but, like, no one else would do that. And
I just have a thing about Netflix always putting their original on material that they actually were not in from the get-go. Because original actually means something, and Netflix really abuses that term by saying Netflix original.
Yeah, I think it can be misleading, but I think that, like, HBO kind of, you know, maybe set that template a decade or two
earlier. And I think Cuarón pointed out backstage at the Golden Globes, like, what other distributor would have put a movie, a black and white film in Spanish and Mixteca, on as many screens as Netflix wound
the
up doing?
The answer is none. I mean, like, the only person, I mean, because my colleague Owen and I kind of debated this, where he's like, you know, he said, like, Fox Searchlight would have done this, except guess what? Fox Searchlight does not release foreign language movies.
That's true.
Period.
Yeah. That is absolutely true.
And they would wait to see how well it did.
You go down the line, it's like Sony Classics. They don't have the essentially $20 million
they don't
that
have
was
the money.
Asked for this movie. And guess who the one person who would do
wait,
it
so
is?
The only thing I want to...
Harvey Weinstein?
Do not speak his name
no,
anymore.
No, but the thing is, what I want to say is, like, it's not so much no one would have done it. It's that, the reason that I started the way I started is a black and white movie set in the early 70s in Mexico, and it's about the main character is an indigenous woman. There are no stars. It is in the economic world that now exists very difficult for anyone else to actually economically justify it. I'm just saying, I'm not in any way making a... I'm just saying that's why. It's not that no one would. It's that very few feel they can.
It would have started with one theater in New York and L.A. If it had done well, then maybe
because
it would have
gone to they were not the only suitors. Yeah. They were not.
Of course.
They were the only ones that... It was a price tag thing that Netflix has so much money. And by the way, your monthly fee is going up. So let's not pretend that this is all like, you know, it's like there's... You know, anyone
having
who,
to make good on this model that was kind of
well, and you're
dreams,
anybody
yeah.
who's subscribing is paying for this. Just as a reminder, you are also paying for this, and that might be fine. And it's just it's where we are at in terms of the American movie industry and the economics of the industry that makes it that no one else could afford it because there were other people who would very much love to have released that movie.
Well, sure. I mean, it's they like it's the Megan Ellison of it all, where, like, you know, she's got these pockets that she wants to open for various auteurs, and a lot of other companies can't or won't, just, you know, in any kind of feasible way. Unfortunately, I wish that I don't know that Annapurna as a distribution entity seems to be working all that well.
I don't know.
No, that's interesting, though, this idea that's Megan Ellison's money. I mean, I like this idea that you basically we're like paying into a fund each month with our Netflix so that we can see the next Martin Scorsese movie or the next Alfonso Cuarón movie, but we also get Mute. You know, it's
exactly and bright.
So many bad things.
So I mean,
the thing that was gross for me was, like, you know, they came out with the numbers for Bird Box and how well that did.
The numbers they
claim.
Here's a movie that, like, and let's even take them at face value. I mean, I'm skeptical too, but, like, you know, there were no numbers for Roma, which tells you that, like, Bird Box, which is the movie that Scott Stuber produced before he was hired at Netflix, and that Universal unloaded or however, I wasn't privy to the deal, but it looks like, by all means, we'd love to give you back your movie, do what you want with it at Netflix. Right. And he supported the hell out of it, and it did well. But it's like, and they've supported the hell out of Roma, and they did not share any numbers of...
Can I just say what quick thing before we talk anymore? They released some numbers in terms of streaming. They didn't release the other very important number, which is the completion rate.
Well, sure.
That is such a big thing. And for them to not do that, because apparently the average completion rate is 30%. So I just want to know how many people actually finish watching Brain. You know, Bird
Brain. I feel
Brain,
the same thing
because I just think it's like the most absurd.
That
movie's
not good, and it's like
it's
the
so not good.
But I mean, it's like it's interesting. I mean, I'm sort
I
of.
I didn't hate it.
I am. Last year, I would think I was really cruel to Netflix in the way that all of
it's
you
okay,
are being,
you can
and
do
it's
it
like
again.
No, but like listen. I mean, as always, I'm trying to be open minded. In my skepticism, you know, and like the, and in a year's time, I've been trying to just sort of pay closer attention to what they're doing. And like, so we, you know, I complained a month ago about this thing with the Bird Box numbers, and people informed me that those numbers mean someone watching 67% of the movie. I think that's pretty damn close to completion. I mean, compare that to TV ratings, where it's like, 11 minutes of a show or something counts as an eyeballs or whatever.
I mean,
it's like,
I would believe those numbers if they said they were completion numbers, but those were not completion numbers. That was not, from my understanding, what they were saying.
I mean, it's like, I don't know how many people stayed awake in the theater for Roma. I mean, it's like the, it's kind of, it's all, I mean, yes, I would like to have those numbers. I don't expect to ever get them.
Nope.
I can do something with the number of how many people watched more than 2/3 of a
Sure.
of a film.
And I'll tell you, I love Roma, but I have to wonder for the average Netflix viewer who like heard good things about it and then like has 10 minutes of that carport getting watched, like how many of you stuck with it? Manola has a hand up.
On Instagram, I had this funny thing with I was going through Instagram and I saw I was quoted for and I was like, all right, I'm going to just put my 2 cents in, like put in more theaters, you know, and they had someone responding. But if you go through any of the like a lot of the Roma stuff on Instagram, so negative. People are, this is the most boring movie I've ever seen. So boring, yeah. So bad. And, you know, you think about, I mean, one of the things that we don't talk about is we don't talk about the situation of watching a movie and you know, the situation of like, imagine that you're not someone who's conversed in art cinema. Mm. Not your fault. I mean, there's a problem in terms of a larger American movie industry.
It
so you don't know that.
It takes a long time to get there.
That's right. And every time we go to Cannes, it takes me usually a day of going, okay, relax. You know, like just to
that's
get,
why we open with Grace of Monaco.
You know, just to, like you
it's
have
so
to
funny.
Settle.
Yeah, movie.
If you're not seeing, if all you're seeing is American mainstream movies, you're going to have a different kind of bodily rhythm.
Yeah.
And
the
first shot of that movie is a very long shot of water. Water and dog excuse me I guess you have to bleep that, sorry. And you know, I can imagine if you're not used to watching a kind of, you know, deliberate cinema, that this might be a little, you know, challenging.
I know two people who have said like, I turned it off after 20 minutes, but I'm going to get back to it.
Right.
I mean,
and
so they're like, they're hopeful. Like they know it was hard for them to start with, but they're going to go back.
Versus your completion rate of actually going to a movie theater and you're sitting in seat and you're like, oh my god, I'm already here, I'm just gonna sit through this, or you're gonna run out of the theater and call maybe your boyfriend or husband or girlfriend.
But let's be clear, like for all the nice things I've been saying about Netflix, Netflix on your television is not the way to watch Roma.
Absolutely.
Unless, and this is where I sort of like kind of had a come around thing. It was the day after Christmas, I drove out to, you know, the Inland Empire and had sort of a day with my family and my, you know, my cousin who is married to a Latinx husband. He and I were having a conversation about Roma, and he lives in Hesperia, and he had sat down and seen it, and it was something that like is possible now. And it was like, well, that
sure
is not, it doesn't excuse the fact that there's almost not a proper way to, you know, see this, or, you know, it's so compromised, but at least it also exists, or it's glass half full.
One of our listeners who we had a club meeting last night and we did a Google Hangout, and he said that he and his family sat and watched Roma and that like no one talked, no one looked at screens, and they all loved it. And so I think there is a way yes, it's not the ideal way to watch that movie, but I think that if you go into it, like you were saying, resetting your internal clock as to what movies do, and you know this isn't going to be like one of the Adam Sandler Netflix originals,
pause.
You know, exactly, and like turn the lights off, shut down your other screens, and like focus. I think you can still enjoy that movie at home.
But this has been the case since VHS was introduced. You know, I mean, this is it's not to say that you can't. I mean, I grew up watching movies on television where you were interrupted all the time. Not the ideal cinematic situation at all.
Martin Scorsese.
Right, pan and scan. So, you know, I think my biggest beef, and I think we've talked about this, is just the way that Netflix you know, doesn't respect theatrical. And my feeling of them not respecting... And
they seem antagonistic towards it. Absolutely. They seem sometimes like they're out to destroy it.
That's my argument with them. They released Netflix... I mean, they released Roma in theaters because they really wanted an Oscar. That's why they did that.
You're just putting me in a position of, like, potentially defending Green Book and potentially defending Netflix because I'm less antagonistic. It's not that I don't agree with you in almost every point.
Well, I mean, yes, I think the awards engine is driving that. But the fact that they did... And here's the thing. You know, for the awards thing, yes, then you open the movie theatrically in New York and L.A. They didn't have to open it in El Paso. They didn't have to open it in a lot of these secondary, tertiary markets where they did. And so...
I think they did, actually. I think they really want the best picture. I think they needed to kind of confirm its theatrical importance. I do honestly think that there was it. I think that it's not a movie... I mean, with Lazaro, they opened for like 1 week in both... that was cursory, probably contractual.
Buster Scruggs and Mowgli, same deal.
Contractual.
But, but it's interesting then that they are both... Y'all are thinking, trying to destroy the theatrical paradigm, but at the same time, obviously acknowledging the importance of the theatrical paradigm if they want this movie
to be... That's why the Bird Box of it all is doubly gross. I mean, like, they didn't do that with Bright. They put that on two screens last year, and Bright was a bigger, more expensive, better movie than Bird Box. You know, it's like the...
Bright was not better than Bird Box. Let's not get crazy.
I mean, I'm the one person who likes Bright, which, all of my credibility just went... What little I had established.
We still love you.
So you're a Max Landis stan then. Okay.
No, I'm a David Ayer devotee. Anyway, I just want to repeat one thing. There is a movie called Sunday's Illness that is incredible, that can only be seen on Netflix, that they did nothing to promote. It was for their other markets. It's a Spanish co-production.
I have literally never heard of this movie until right now.
So that on I'm your writing, Netflix.
Sunday's Illness is really good.
Okay, I'm writing it down.
It's very good.
It's in the vein of I Am Love. It's that sort of like lavish, heightened, emotional thing about a mother who's basically scrubbed from her narrative the existence of a daughter from a previous... I don't even think it was a marriage. It was like from before she was married to a rich, kind of aristocrat. And that daughter, now grown... kind of crashes back into her life and demands 10 days together. And
it's beautifully, beautifully made.
So here's the thing. 3 out of 5 movie critics are not familiar with this title, which in some ways explains my problem with Netflix. I mean, it's just the way that for Netflix, like every, American movie industry, the old model, the old studios, even the kind of the latter day versions of that, they want to make money. So let's not pretend otherwise. At the same time, they're just releasing those movies and they're doing, they did for a long time until things started to fall apart. And we can talk about Fox and poor Paramount soon. But at least they were promoting movies. Netflix, it's just product, really. It's just product. And so they have different things that they want to do. But you'll have these movies that just disappear and they get no traction and then you just can't find them.
Has anyone seen the Uruguayan film A 12-Year Night that was Uruguayan?
Right, like that. That was
showing the Oscars.
Last year's My Happy Family from Georgia, which was on my top 10 list.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about the Uruguayan movie, like it showed at the Palm Springs Film Festival 2-3 weeks after it was on Netflix because it was part of their foreign language. That's an emphasis they have at Palm Springs.
They show all the Oscar contenders, right?
And I had my colleague, send him to review it and he contacted Netflix just for credits and information. They were like, that movie's come and gone, we don't care, don't
oh
bother.
No they don't the, yeah know, see like, I review when I review
they
these
don't
Netflix,
even want
when I
review
Netflix movies for the LA Times, they don't have production notes ever.
Oh, God,
they don't have information to give me. They will, I mean, they'll, it's really, it's odd. I mean, and but the funny thing is though, now I'm seeing things like, because of it, I'm seeing movies like Sunday's Illness, I'm seeing movies like A 12-Year Night, but I'm also seeing things like they just put out their first Nollywood original. They're putting out, called Lionheart, this Nigerian like comedy, made by one of their biggest stars, a woman directing.
They
for
have
the first
Girl,
time.
Which is maybe a movie that's problematic, but it's like the
are they putting these in
major.
Theaters?
No, in the case of Lionheart, that just went out. In some cases, they play in theaters. Sunday's Illness got a week long.
My take on Sunday's Illness is that it was
probably the Monica in LA in Santa Monica, Emily Monica plays it for a week.
I think Netflix is an international company, and that in some of the countries it does business, a prerequisite of doing business there is creating enough local content. And so they're motivated to co-produce with some of these countries, TV series especially, because you can generate a lot. And then they do it for those countries. And so the fact of it being a Netflix original, I mean, it is that, Sunday's Illness, it was never a foreign American audience. It's on the service, but it's like, it's designed for different Spanish speaking
markets. Yeah, Lionheart is not for an American audience. It is for, I mean, it's probably for a diaspora in America.
So it's less sinister than it sounds. And in some ways, it's less sinister than Mr. Weinstein used to do, where he would gobble up all these movies and leave them on shelves.
Yeah,
you know?
Just to not have them compete with the movies he did want to.
Right, this is a model that the studios have been doing for a while. I mean, Fox would do these, South Korean productions, and maybe sometimes they'd be invited to Cannes, like Yellow Sea, for example.
Yeah,
I
saw some Argentine film with Viggo Mortensen in it speaking Spanish.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, biopic.
Yeah.
It's very smart. I mean, it's a really smart model to basically a way Fox International of having these local productions. And what's really weird, I mean, wasn't there a Japanese version of Sideways? I remember, like, they'll sometimes remake American movies specifically for that market.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
Well, has anybody seen any of the versions of Perfect Strangers? Do y'all know about this phenomenon? So, Pantaleon just put out this Mexican film called Perfect Strangers.
Yeah. Right.
And apparently it's a remake of an Italian film, which has been remade everywhere.
Like five or six.
There's like a
Turkish
languages. One and a South Korean one. There was a Spanish one that Alex de la Iglesia did. And it's a very fundamental premise. A group of friends gathers at a dinner party. They all put their cell phones on the table. And any texts that come in, everybody gets to see. And, you know, wackiness ensues.
Oh, funny. Okay.
And it has become this thing like Ugly Betty, where like every country is doing their own version.
Or like Welcome to the Styx. I feel like America is the only country, I mean, at least all of Europe remade that Danny Boone movie that was such a hit in France. Will Smith was supposed to do it here.
Weinstein was supposed to do the Perfect Strangers remake. Now it's in limbo. But yeah, so it's interesting how there are these kind of global phenomena where, like, let's take this movie and just do it for, you know, specific audiences.
Yes, the Japanese Sideways was made in 2009, by the way. So, yeah.
It's interesting. What about...
Should we carry on with the best?
By all means. I know Robert and I were big fans of, speaking of movies that you've really got to hunt down and hopefully will become more accessible in 2019 via streaming or whatever. We were both big fans of A Bread Factory.
I came here today thinking that if we get into like, you talk about something that no one's seen and you have to search for, I would want to mention A Bread Factory.
I should search for it. I mean, like, I was aware of it. It's a two-part, four-hour movie.
It's a four-hour,
from a filmmaker whose other movies are kind of hidden on the dark side
also
of the moon,
hard,
but beloved.
Hard to find.
This is a queer Asian filmmaker who, like, has gotten Spirit Award nominations, but, you know, Patrick Wang has somehow not managed to become part of the conversation, even in, like, queer circles. Like, I'm still a programmer.
In the Family has to be like one of the most like moving tales of gay tales I've ever seen.
Yeah,
I think.
But I've heard more about that movie in the context of the Spirit Awards that year than I ever have on like the sort of Outfest, Frameline, Newfest circuit. I don't know what it is about this guy where he kind of falls between the cracks.
He refuses to make anything that he doesn't have total control over, and he's just willing to like. I mean, he's huge in France. I just want to say he's really big in France.
Not really. I mean, like his films get released there. So, for instance, that one that was at South by Southwest, I believe, was the festival, got released in France
Grief
2 years
Others.
Before, right? Because that came out.
That's a 3-year-old
just this
movie,
year,
yeah.
Finally, but like. I mean, so he, but big, no. I mean, like,
well,
James,
I mean, I'm just
James
I'm
Gray
saying
is big
huge in
France,
France
you
in
know,
that, in
like,
that way that we talk about Jerry Lewis. But I mean, like, it's more just like he has a following in France.
Right. But he probably has fewer followers collectively there than he does here. I mean, it's like, it's just,
right,
yeah,
gotcha.
The movies
yeah.
come out.
But anyway, A Bread Factory is a two-part, four-hour movie about a beleaguered community arts center in a small town in New York, a fictional town. And it is a tapestry of great characters. And it is one of those movies that just remind you why and how you fell in love with the arts.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I would just say is I'm not very familiar with his work, is that the movies are long and they haven't had, you
in
know,
the family,
they
don't have stars,
distributors.
And they don't have distributors. So if you don't, if they haven't really kind of hit, it's because, you know, they're long and they don't have distributors. And it's very difficult for American real American independent cinema. It's a very difficult game and has been really for the last 10 years.
He finally had a few actors of note in
Bread Factory.
Yeah,
Tyne
Daly is
Tyne
one of the leads in Bread Factory. There's a great scene
that's
with
not Ginny. The biggest one, though, is it?
No, that is, actually.
She's probably
she's
the name,
she's
yeah.
the main.
I mean, Glynis O'Connor is in it, and you haven't seen Glynis O'Connor
in
ages.
Glynis O'Connor is so great in this.
She's so wonderful
and
in it.
Janine Garofalo has a hilarious scene as a filmmaker doing a Q&A. It's like the funniest
I think I just knew she
Q&A
was
sequence
it,
I've ever seen
but
in a
But Tyne Daly is the star of them. I mean, if you can say that there's a star, she's one of the two leads.
But thank you for reminding about that. You know, it's like that is, I mean, there are some that are at a level above that. I mean, the We the Animals, the, you know, the
We
kind
the
of,
Animals.
I mean, the writer has had this second wind, you know, like, which, I mean, that's maybe my favorite movie of the last
couple
years.
It was so nice to see
years,
the National Society of Film Critics give that Best Picture.
But that was a movie that kind of, when it finally opened, despite having won every festival it had gone to, from, you know, the Cannes Director's Fortnight to, you know, to Iceland. Like, it came out, it had been nominated for, you know, a Best Picture Spirit Award, you know, it's like, and then it comes out and it kind of like, you know, barely makes a splash, you know.
I mean, I think that, you know, I'm glad that Harvey Weinstein is gone from American independent cinema and he will not be back. He just won't. There's no coming back for him, unlike someone like, you know, Louis C.K., who's going to have, you know, already started to mount some sort of comeback. But one of the things that I think we have to think about is the landscape of American independent cinema post Miramax and post Weinstein. It's really hard. It's really hard even for good movies. And one of the movies that I would also say that is, you know, that I really liked a great deal from last year is Support the Girls.
Yes.
You know, by Andrew Bajowski. Yeah. And we've all seen it and we all have been following Bajowski's career for a really long time. And you know, it had good reviews in mainstream publications by, you know, it got attention and it made exactly $129,124 at the American box office.
Oh, my God.
So we know
it is such an entertaining movie.
I know,
too.
But
I
just
find that so weird.
There is what I'm trying to say. It's like we are so dominated by a certain number of movies, you know, that, and they take up so much mind share also, not just the way they dominate, you know, particularly Disney, anything with a Disney name on it. And then but all of us talk about all these other movies and maybe people are going to, you know, discover these movies, you know, on, you know, streaming at some point. But there is a huge divide between so many of the movies that we like that end up on our top 10s and top 50 movie lists and what people are seeing, you know. And I think, and sometimes I do think that the divide is just getting larger and it's worrisome to me.
I think to your point, I mean, yeah, Harvey Weinstein is a despicable human being, but boy, did he know how to sell these movies. Like, he had a sort of almost William Castle-esque brand of hucksterism that I think put butts in seats for movies that traditionally wouldn't have.
No, but
you know?
It also made you not like the movie. I mean, you could sit there and like one of his movies, and then like the amount of selling that was going on would just make you not want to even think about the movie anymore. It just got,
but
it
you
got
can't.
So,
I mean, you just have to put that aside.
I mean, like,
how
many people would have seen
so
The Crying Game, for instance? Yeah. Like, had he not really worked that? You got to see it before somebody spoils it.
And you can't talk about it.
Exactly.
You know, they sent out. I remember I was at the Village Voice. And they sent out these letters, you know, telling us that nobody could talk about it. You know what I mean? He really had people. I mean, I really feel like Netflix has kind of taken over the Miramax thing.
I mean,
you know,
yes, when like he got Kofi Annan to talk about how great Chocolat was, it was like, Harvey, calm down.
Well,
I think he did know how to really kind of hustle these movies to a public that was not necessarily ready to embrace them.
Yeah, I mean, the Miramax thing is kind of like, you know, splintered out into other aspects of that personality. Like in Amazon, we see people acquiring or producing these kinds of films. You know, You Were Never Really Here was one of the great films of last year. Lynn Ramsey's movie with, for me, the best performance has ever done. We don't all feel that way.
We do not.
I'm in between you two.
Gesundheit and all that. But it's an example, again, of a bold, you know, risk, at least, at the very least. You know, it's like but Amazon's doing it in a classier kind of way. Cold War maybe is a better example of a, you know, an acquisition by them that is you know, an exceptional film, and you know, they're getting
Powell feels like he's having a career that, like, a classic career you would have had in the 50s or 60s as an international art house, like, beloved director. I mean, like, you feel like he's developing that, like, he has fans now probably over here, like, as people who love Ida love Cold War, and you know, it's like, he's just kind of fascinating.
Well, it's almost becoming shtick for him. It's like, he's figured out, like, oh, this works, you know, this kind of Academy ratio,
you
black
still
and
have
white.
This kind of career.
I wouldn't be surprised if Paul Schrader's next movie is also, like, in the vein of First Reformed, because that worked for him, and you're rewarded with a certain kind of adulation in that mode. And it's like, well,
Schrader's next movie will be about a donkey who suffers.
By the way, can I just say, I just want to say one of my favorite things about 2018.
Jokes, yeah, so high culture, I can't believe it.
One of my favorite things about 2018 was the return of, since we've mentioned Cold War and First Reformed, the return of the Academy ratio as a format for filmmakers to explore, and I just think that's fantastic.
You know, it's interesting. It's worth interjecting. Like, you know, I really do love Roma, but apparently not as much as I'm supposed to. You know, and one of the things that I resisted in it was one of the things I resisted in, what was that movie, The Revenant? Where it's like you have a really, it's the cinematography. So that's one of the things that's being celebrated. It's in black and white, so everyone looks at it differently, or like, I don't know. Black and white is a choice, and it lends a certain kind of attention to the cinematography. But the crispness, the sort of patina or whatever, the lack of a patina, I don't know, on every image is almost a detractor for me. Whereas I think in those movies that feel classical, it's almost, you know, that's, I just have to wrap my brain around this new aesthetic that he's kind of putting forward, which is, I think, Cuarón's interpretation of what art house cinematography looks like. But he's not imitating it. He's kind of, you know,
doing
it,
his own thing, you could say. Originally.
I mean, I joked that movie was like directed by an oscillating room fan. Every shot is at a certain distance.
And kind of like, excuse me, I'm going to be taking Peter outside and beating him up.
This is maybe why it sits at number 12 or 14 in my list and not on the 10. But
I mean, I think, you know, aesthetically, I mean, I find it, you know, a remarkable film, obviously. One of the reasons I don't think it's... I think it's wonderful that people can see it if they do not have access to an art cinema. I just want to get that out of the way. Sure. Mm-hmm. If they do have access to an art cinema, get out of your house, for God's sake.
I got to see it in 70 at the Egyptian. It was stunning. So for the sound design as much as for the way it looks.
I wonder if 70 corrects that crispness that, like, you know, of the digital. But sorry,
that's interesting because it would soften it because it was
less resolution.
It was shot in digital, so it's all information, right? It's all data. Right. And so there's, you know, I said it was, you know, it's made in black and white, but technically it's just a bunch of stuff, right? That they are, then he polished in the cinematography. It's really interesting to talk about cinematography in the age of digital, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it is data coming in. And it doesn't look like what we actually see looking into the world. And it's all manipulated. So it's all post.
Post has as much to do.
It's all post. And that's a really interesting...
And Netflix, you have to pay more for definition, apparently, right? Like a couple bucks more HD, I think?
I don't know.
I think you pay more for Blu-rays than DVDs, but I don't think there's a difference.
They also had that movie Outlaw King that opened the Toronto Film Festival.
I reviewed that.
Shot in 8K. You know, it's like that. I mean, that's information that we don't even know what to do with yet.
Special K.
Anyway, I interrupted you there.
No, but I think that's interesting. Maybe we're going down. Maybe I'm going down to abstract rabbit hole. But I just think it's really interesting to think about. Think about cinematography in the age of digital is a really interesting thing.
Well, because
Roma looks really different from Cold War, which looks like that's a class.
Roma looks different from everything. That's exciting and enervating. Right.
But I mean, also, like, when's the last time that anybody actually made enough black and white stock to shoot a feature on? Like, I know Man Who Wasn't There was shot on color and transferred. Turned into black and white. I assume Schindler's List probably was.
Well, not
as
only
well,
that
right?
is like, I mean, they have
well,
to do it that way because.
Forever. But I mean, like, I mean, oh, you mean like the fact that shoot on color?
It's like an insurance
policy. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, in some markets it might come out in color. Like, remember that movie with that John Boorman movie that was released both ways? Yeah.
Oh,
it was the General released in color.
I did not know that.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
I think it was released abroad in color.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. Saving Ted Turner and his troubles.
Right, exactly.
You don't have to colorize anything.
We did have that hilarious contretemps this year from a certain online columnist who will go unnamed, who was convinced that there was a color version of Roma because somebody had taken a picture of their TV screen and had kind of a bluish
tint to
it.
No.
And he would not be dissuaded that there was not a secret color version of Roma.
Go ahead and name names because I don't like this person at all.
I don't want to promote Jeff Wells. Yeah. Anyway, that was just a funny
thing
that happened.
That's hilarious.
What a funny conspiracy theory.
Right?
From an idiot.
So, are you super excited about Marvel movies anymore? Did Black Panther make the Marvel? Let's rewind.
Black Panther is dead.
Did Black Panther in any way...
Did it feel like a rewriting of the...
Did it change how you feel about Marvel? Because I just was wondering about my exhaustion with the Marvel world.
It gave me hope of the idea of Marvel being open to auteurs. Because when they fired Edgar Wright from Ant-Man, mm-hmm. that seemed like, okay, so this is going to be... Mm-hmm. This is like a TV studio where like everybody's got to sort of follow this line and hew to this sort of corporate mindset of what these movies are like, and that Kevin Feige is the real auteur here.
Right, right.
But I think they let Ryan Coogler be Ryan Coogler.
Yeah, I think so too.
And tell it in a way visually and narratively that didn't feel of a piece. And so I would like to think that they're not... This means they're not closed off to that sort of thing.
But I think it helps when Ryan Coogler wants to meet them at least halfway. I mean, like, I think mm-hmm. It's not like Ryan Coogler is going to offer them anything. I mean, if you see Creed, you know, it's like, yeah, of course you could make a Marvel movie because he wants to tell an entertaining movie in as entertaining a way as possible. So that's not going to like upset them very much.
It's not Godard's Marvel.
And if they're upset with Edgar Wright, I mean, I don't know
that's the thing. It's like when Lord and Miller got fired from Solo, but then moved over to Into the Spider-Verse, and it's like, well, I know which movie I'd rather watch.
So I heard an amazing story about Marvel.
Do tell.
And I can't tell the source. I mean, but I believe it. So the story is that Marvel has invited in for meetings Claire Denis.
I've heard the same thing.
Mia Hansen-Love and Lucretia Martel.
Yes,
I heard about Lucretia Martel.
And so what this tells me is not that they're going to make movies with them, but they are open to the idea of hearing from these auteurs. And that's where you have to have another side of this, is that I think Claire Denis might just take that meeting for, you know,
to have the
for
story.
Yucks. Yeah. You know, it's like the...
Chloe Zhao is working with Marvel.
Yeah, I mean, like, of the people that we put on Variety's 10 directors to watch list a year ago, if you'd asked me which of these is the first, you know, to make a Marvel movie, my last answer would have been Chloe Zhao. You know, it's like the... So that's how you get is it Anna Boden who's doing Captain Marvel?
Yes, and Ryan Fleck.
From the Half Nelson duo, you know, it's like there's a combination of two things. The fact that Marvel's open to meeting with these people blows my mind and is an encouraging thought.
Sure.
The trade-off is... Who among them really want to make these movies? And we're learning that.
But
you know?
I just say, like, all the foreign filmmakers, all the filmmakers from other parts of the world back in the 50s and 60s met with all the studios. They always met with the studios too. I mean, the studios
They wanted Truffaut or Godard to direct Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah,
that happened all the time.
But I would say that it is interesting, given that the American movie industry of the 1950s is not the American movie industries of 2018. Sure. It's much more corporate. But, it's much more, you know, I mean, it's a very different.
Marvel.
Yeah. But let's also not forget the behemoth that was the Twilight franchise. When they got to their last chapter, they reached out to Bill Condon, who ended up taking the gig, Sofia Coppola, and Gus Van Sant. So it was sort of like, all right, we have this built-in audience. What if we also tried to, like, make something that's, you know...
But what I'd like to...
Gus Van Sant's Twilight.
That, is that Marvel is so confident... What I'd like
Those
to say
shirtless
is that
werewolves would have been all over it.
Marvel is so confident in their minting money, you know, abilities that they're just going now, okay, what are some of the quirkier, weirder stories in our arsenal that could go to a director like that? And if they're willing to make that, what would that Could we make that work?
Here's what I think it is, actually. And I mean, like, even though I chose to interpret that as a good sign that Marvel is open to these things, is, like, I think the dirty secret is franchise movies are not made by directors anymore. They're made by producers and the machine. And you get
and
an
the
indie,
VFX. And the
if
VFX,
they ever were. I mean, it's like the 007
and
movies were.
And the previs directors are directing all those
sequences.
Yeah,
so you've got the cinematographer and the visual effects director and the second unit person and the producer and, like... And so what happens, like, when people get booted off of a solo movie is we realize that, like, oh, who's really steering the ship on these things? Or, like, when Colin Trevorrow's second film is a Jurassic World film, you know, guess who directed that? Not Colin Trevorrow. You know, it's like, well, what he does is he brings in the indie spice.
I'm just imagining this lunch.
Okay.
Of the guy saying, yeah, I watched half of your little Beau Travail. What else do you do? Like, that's, I want to be there to hear
Claire Denis have that meeting.
Her new movie's a sci-fi film, so I'm sure they saw that.
Okay, yeah, it's a sci-fi film.
It's a Claire Denis science fiction film.
Solaris is.
It's like you made a movie with Robert Pattinson.
So, okay, I agree with some of what Peter just said, and I disagree with some of it. I think that... You know, when you hire that for these franchise movies, I think that you are entrusting that the director can handle the actors mainly, what you're doing. And that's their main thing. And that's not a small thing, as we know. Right. I mean, part of the great pleasure of Black Panther is it's really well cast and really well acted. It just is.
It's full of personality.
Absolutely. Ooh. And that these are, you know, it's even these secondary roles. Someone doesn't have a lot of lines. They bring so much humanity, life, you know, that it really is a deeply enriching experience. And that's part of it. So I think that, you know, the other stuff is the machine that you plug that person into, you know. Right. And so, you know, I agree.
The hard part almost is the part that the director is handling. And it's just the thing that's complicated.
I think they're handed this big machine. Yeah. And they're going to say, and this big machine is already running, my friend. And it's been running since the Marvel film started. But you are nonetheless responsible for this. And you can really screw up that big machine. And that's a really big problem. And I think I would say that, what's that horrible movie that came out last year? Solo? Is that just the name of it?
Yeah.
Solo?
Yeah.
You know, that's a perfect example of, you know, you fire the directors. I don't know how, you know, and I think they're talented. They're very talented. That movie is a dud.
Yeah.
That movie has...
You, like, snuff the light at the center of it.
It is shockingly terrible.
If the job, as you're saying, for the director is to put a soul in the machine, you know, which is why, like, Shane Black's Iron Man 3 is way better than whoever did Iron Man 2, you know, Ron Howard is not going to put a soul in anything. And so that's when you wind
He's
up a solo.
He's made a couple movies
he
I like.
He has. No, absolutely. Yeah, but
Splash
but,
and Rush.
Franchises are now being treated like TV shows are. There's a director who does a pilot who establishes a look, and then you have hire other directors to do other episodes. If you need a change, you know, you get a new showrunner. It's like that's how these franchises are being treated now. It's like they're just basically these things that are going to exist. And sometimes you get a big name involved.
But I think actually the director is still important. I guess that was my direct. And I actually don't always think that's true of episodic television. I mean, it depends on who.
These directors are not directing. Like, I mean, you know, they're not directing the 15-minute action sequence. It's being handed off to a special.
Oftentimes, in even smaller action films, there's a second unit who's doing the action.
Yeah, so,
you know,
but when you see Mad Max Fury Road. That's a George Miller movie.
Hello.
From beginning to end. And so
but
you
I'm
know
glad
that
Mignola,
you know, action movies can still be
specified that. I mean even though like I'm facetiously, I'm kind of like arguing the other thing, but it's like, I mean, I don't know that they're, it doesn't feel like the director is in charge, but it does feel like they're still responsible for the most important part of it, which is the human part, which is the thing that like is the dynamic between the actors.
Yeah.
It is the performances.
So when I walk away from Black Panther and the parts that are sticking in my head are the moments with Michael B. Jordan. Like, you know, his whole character just, you know, dealing with all this stuff he's going through. It's like, I know that's Ryan Coogler.
Can we just talk a little bit about Michael Jordan? I think he's a tremendous actor.
We can spend the rest of the time talking about
Michael. Hi, can we please talk about Michael? I mean, I just think that his performance in Black Panther is one of the great performances from last year.
Oh, totally.
I mean, I just
agree. Yeah.
And I don't actually think, I, you know, he's not being talked to. I mean, I don't follow the Oscar race that closely, but... That is a truly great performance.
I think if I had one thing that for me is sort of a flaw for Black Panther is that Black Panther's the least interesting character.
Yeah. Movies are made broken by their villains. Right.
Even the like Shuri and like the women around him are way more interesting.
Yeah,
his
sister is, I think, you know. Yeah. I mean, I want her to have her own movie. I mean, in a way, the idea that they were so easily able to. I mean, who knows what the ending of like, you know, Avengers blah blah blah, you know, sort of was about, but like the idea that you can just kind of like snuff him out and move on. It was like, A, they didn't seem to think that, you know, Black Panther was going to be what it was going to be, but also it's like, well, I just care about the other people. Where do they stand?
Peter,
no one dies in these movies.
They snuffed out Spider-Man, and we're already seeing trailers for his next movie. Let's not get too invested in the end of Infinity War.
Didn't all the Avengers die?
I assure you.
I think everybody but the raccoon dies, basically.
I mean, it literally doesn't matter. You know, like.
I would like to be elitist and obscure for a moment.
Yes, please.
We count on you for that.
Here's what I really loved this year. I'm just going to name titles. The Linoleum Knife people have heard me talk about these movies all year, but I'm just going to hammer them into your head one more time, because by now, maybe you've been able to find them streaming somewhere if they haven't come to your little town or your big town even. But here's what I loved. I loved a documentary called Good Luck by a director named Ben Russell. It's about Serbian miners, the first half, and the second half is about gold miners in Suriname. And it's unpleasant, but you should see it. I liked another documentary called Elmar Lamar. It's sort of an abstract experimental thing about border crossings from the people from the Harvard Ethnography Lab.
Do you remember the directors, please?
Josh Boneta and J.P. Sniedek.
Oh, Sniedek. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's one that Elmar Lamar is one of my very favorite films of the year. It's not long, but it is about what it means to be on the border of Mexico and the United States in a very intimate and a frightening way. It's about the feeling I got from it mostly over everything else was just this inescapable loneliness of what it means to be out there, where no matter if you live out there on the border or if you're crossing it. I liked a film called Western.
Oh yes, very good.
About Bosnian work. No, wait.
Where is he from again?
They're working at a hydroelectric plant in... Now I'm blanking on the country. Anyway, we talked about that a lot. I liked En el Séptimo Día.
Yeah.
It was Jim McKay's movie, yeah, which
Jim
is the
McKay's
other...
back.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Monrovia, Indiana.
Yeah.
Yay, Wiseman. No.
Wiseman.
Milford Graves' Full Mantis, about the jazz drummer Milford Graves. And,
I missed that one.
And he was... It is the wildest music documentary I've seen in some time.
Thank you for reminding me of that.
I liked Five Seasons, The Gardens of Pete Oldolf. I don't know how you say his last name.
Was that the gardening?
Very quiet movie. And just so, like, the kind of thing I want from a Pichapong or a Sethakun, where I get my heart rate slowed down. That's what I got from this one.
Did you see the documentary In the Intense Now, which was one of my favorite documentaries?
I have not seen that.
That's the Polish one?
No, it's the Walter Salles' brother made
that
it about.
Not what I thought
about. Brazilian director, but it's about it takes archival footage from the 1968 uprisings in around the world that were going on, but it's a great archival documentary about how uprisings like flower and then fall apart, and it uses footage of his mother who had gone to China in 68 and took all this beautiful color footage of her and her friend's trip, and it's just this idea that like this touristy kind of like footage, but there's a revolution going on at the same time, and so he wants to explore revolutions and how they're recorded and who's recording them and what it means when they kind of like dissipate, and the footage, which uses a lot of Paris in 68, is just incredible, and it's an essay, so he talks over it, and just I think it's just a great documentary.
Say the name again.
In the Intense Now.
In the Intense Now. Yeah. Okay. I loved, well, these aren't These others aren't obscure. I loved Lean on Pete. It filled me with anxiety and the only other film that much less good movie that filled me with that much anxiety was Boy Erased, but for entirely different reasons.
Much better movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. As I said when we talked about it on the show, I don't even know if Boy Erased is a good or bad film at all, because I was so freaked out during the last 15 minutes that I couldn't even process.
No, what I can tell you, it's a bad film.
No, yeah.
It took me three nights to get through it.
I'm not cheering for it on any level. All I know is that the subject matter, the thing they got perfectly right.
Nicole Kidman was perfectly accurately right.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to dog on Boy Erased. I thought we were talking about
Beautiful Boy.
Beautiful Boy.
Oh, no, that's a terrible movie.
I still haven't. The screener of Beautiful Boy is sitting by our television. I still haven't gotten.
Boy Erased is in the family of films that Green Book is in. But
really good Nicole Kidman performance,
yes.
I think. Really strong.
The thing I talked about earlier on two different shows is Boy Erased gets evangelical toxicity perfectly right.
And then Miseducation of Cameron Post gets closet anxiety.
Queer teen desire, right? You know, so together together they make an okay movie. but the evangelical toxicity was what kind of did me in for Boy Erased, because I grew up in that.
Yeah.
Zama, which we've all discussed before. I really like Never Going Back.
Oh my God, Never Going Back.
Irresponsible teenage.
No, Never Going Back. Never Going Back is so much. I like that movie so
much.
Thank
you for the shout out to that.
Yeah.
And
from the wife of David Lowery.
Yes. Augustine Frizzell.
Who is her own major talent.
Yeah.
Who, believe it or not, really was pulling from her life for that movie, which
and if I don't get
mind-blowing to me.
A weekly Tea with the Dames TV show, I'm going to riot. Because I have not enjoyed myself more watching 85-year-old women straight up crack on each other for 90 minutes ever in my life before this. And I want more and more and more, because there are plenty of other old actors out there who know each other and are friends and would sit around happily and talk ish to each other the way these
I see
do.
A Netflix series.
Yeah. I was saying in 40 years I want Tea with the Spice Girls.
Oh, one more thing.
Tea with the Spice Girls.
The costumes and progressive sexuality of the Superfly remake
were
underseen and underappreciated.
That is the movie that people really slept on this year, that was a lot of fun and so great to look at and listen to. I really enjoyed Superfly, and everybody forgets that it even happened. But
the soundtrack is fantastic. Future is being very mean to Sierra right now, and I understand that that's a problem, but his soundtrack is terrific.
I like when movies, like when you look at movies on your list and you think like, oh, there's an interesting connection between these two. Like, I mean, the way like Borders have played a part in various movies this year, the way people's relationship to their work life has played a part in some of the great movies of the year.
There's somebody online who does like these compilations of movies that had this and this. Like they paired the Favorite and Destroyer both have desultory hand jobs in them.
or how about I love the way like Happy as Lazaro and Shoplifters both have like families of grifters, like, you know, living off the grid. And I love the way, like, you know, just those guys, I'm just like, I love when I look at a list and I'm like, oh, interesting.
Well, and when that happens, it tends to happen at a festival, because you see these masterpieces in proximity or something, and you're like, you know, oh, there's a, you know, a scene involving a refrigerator, whatever, left open or something. I don't know. Can we also pitch in some small titles?
I love that.
I mean, your listeners are sophisticated enough to appreciate these films, you know?
Well, we badger them into it.
I'm just trying to butter them up for my suggestions. I like your shirt,
I believe that our listeners are quite sophisticated, because they stuck with us.
That's
so.
Right. Bless them.
Yeah. I like your perfume. Now listen to my suggestions. Well, you mentioned Blindspotting, which isn't that obscure a film, but it's a lot of people didn't see it, you know, from Sundance last year. But Life and Nothing More, which I think is just an incredible incredible movie by a Spanish filmmaker who went to Florida and, you know, sort of got in that sort of way that sometimes foreign eyes can see American stories better. You know, like,
and non-professional use of non-professional.
A story about a single mother and, you know, her two children and, like, you
Regina
know,
Williams, right? Is that her name?
That's right.
Yeah, she's an extraordinary performance.
And her son, who is at this age where, you know, kind of like he can kind of be set on the right course, or he can be thrown into the system. For me, in some ways, I mean, I don't mean to set this against other movies, but it's like, I didn't have the deep reaction to If Beale Street Could Talk that other people did, although I love what it represents, and I love that novel, and like, and in a way, that sort of thing about the way the criminal justice system, you know, can devour, but also like there are elements of the criminal justice system you see, like him in kind of like in these kind of like what would you call the thing where you're kind of put in the equivalent of detention after, you know, kind of like and they're trying to coach you on the right path and whether you, you know, go along with that or not, you know, the I think a lot of those things are in this film. Museo, for me, was the Mexican movie of the year.
I heard that was good. I haven't seen it yet.
The Alonso Ruiz Palacios had made a movie called Gueros a few years ago, and both of those movies, you know, came out of Berlin, as did Sunday's Illness, which is probably why most of you haven't heard of it. Berlin is a festival we tend not to give as much attention to, but like
Berlin 2019, Varda by Agnes. I can't wait.
And then a movie that I feel like sort of is on no one's radar, just a Berlin film from a year earlier that went straight to DVD via Film Movement, called In Syria. It had the original horrible title of Insyriated. But like, I feel like, you know, we're all drowning in these kind of movies about the Syria crisis, and, you know, a lot of them are documentaries, and we're, I mean, no conflict apparently has been as documented as the Syrian one, just by virtue of media and cameras and all this kind of stuff. By the way, I loved A Personal War too, which kind of, I guess, ends in Syria. But for me, that's the best
thing. You
mean
a private war.
A private war. Like, the best thing I think I've seen Rosamund Pike ever do, which is, I mean, anyway, I don't need to dog on her while complimenting her. I mean, it's like
but nicely done.
She's incredible in this. It's like I was just trying to think of other things that I would put on that list, and I don't know. But
She's often the best thing in a so-so movie, like the
she can be.
But the women who go on strike and dabbing him or whatever about stuff like that. I mean, you know, Gone Girl, come on. She's, you know, that's...
I mean, that's a movie that uses her weaknesses as its strengths, in the way that I think, you know, Manchester by the Sea uses Casey Affleck's limited range to its advantage. I mean, it's like sometimes you can employ an actor's kind of limited toolkit.
I know.
You're very good at that. Yeah. You're very good at the combination, like, the backhanded compliment. You're very good.
But it's like the. But no, I mean, I saw things in Rosamund Pike's performance in A Personal War that I didn't know
private
she
war.
Could do. A private war. Thank you. In Syria, just for context, is sort of this story about a family that chooses to stay behind after kind of all the bombing and stuff has happened, and it's a horrible decision. They have no electricity. They have no water. And like, and they're constantly being shot at and shelled, and it's kind of, I mean, it's almost like it could be like an episode of The Walking Dead or something. I mean, it's like they could be zombies outside trying to get in, but in this case, it's just, you know, rebels and kind of everything breaking down. But what I loved about it is it puts me, a Westerner, into that situation in a way that I'd never quite related to this horrible, horrible thing. And it just starts by like panning around this living room that could look like yours. I mean, it's bookshelves, and it's, I mean, it's a, kind of a Western intellectual family. And Hiyam Abbas, the great, is she Palestinian actress, plays the matriarch in this. She, I mean, you might know her from Blade Runner 2049. She's the, like, you know, a plot thread that kind of never went anywhere. The woman with one eye who's, you know, kind of a rebel leader. I mean, one of the world's great actresses plays this mother who's kind of like trying to keep the unit together there. And I mean, the whole thing is tight and intense and sort of put me into this, you know, this ongoing crisis, humanitarian crisis, in a way that no other film had. Yeah.
I'm just going to put a little shout out to a movie that I think very few people saw called Did You Wonder Who Fired the Gun?
Oh, Dave saw it.
Of course. by Travis Wilkerson. And it's a really lacerating investigation into racism told through the murder of a black man by a white man who happens to be related to the filmmaker. And it's a, this filmmaker kind of, who is really, really great and is actually an authentic leftist. I mean, it's not just, it, and really kind of interrogating racism and, you know, white identity. And it's truly, truly great. And it's great. And I love that it's really angry. It's really angry about race. Really, it's a furious movie. And I think it, it brings the kind of, the depth of emotion that needs to be brought to bear and which we don't see in a movie like Green Book.
Okay. I want to give, speaking of movies about dealing with racial topics, I want to give a shout out to Hale County This Morning, This Evening, which is a movie that I like more the more that I sat on it. My my initial reaction to it was, you know, it felt, I don't know if it was, I felt it sort of exploitative or whatever, but the more that I think about it, the more I feel like it is really this kind of compassionate portrait of this community, and it's a movie that really stayed with me.
Ramel Ross is the filmmaker, and I mean, I think that it's interesting because it's an experimental documentary, if we want to class it, you know, in some way, though that seems kind of too narrow. It's very essayistic, you know, word I apparently can't pronounce. And I think that if you've seen a lot of experimental film, it will seem somewhat familiar in a lot of ways. I don't, but with this particular subject that he's looking at, it makes it unusual.
So yeah, no, I think it's a movie that you actually feel the filmmaker discovering things
absolutely,
as he's making
it.
That,
that's along.
Actually where the joy and the wonder of the movie is that the filmmaker is going, wow, I'm seeing this for the first time because I have a camera and I'm looking at this way, and it's now it's so beautiful to me. And you always get that from every frame of that movie.
Well, he refuses to use the shorthand of certain documentaries, of certain representations of race and all these kind of things. And so it's not necessarily that he's finding better answers. He's just, it's interesting to find a movie that is absent certain, you know, conclusions, certain dramatic setups. Like, I mean, the thing that I liked about Life and Nothing More, that's about kind of like, will this kid make it or not? It's like, well, that's kind of maybe a false sense of expectation on this kind of story, and it's like, and it also puts things in kind of a narrow framework. It's just observational. It has this kind of amazing thing where two consecutive shots will speak to each other in this way that just is, you know, surprising. Like, you know, just that aspect of montage. It's not fluid the whole way through, but it's almost like these little pairings, you know, throughout. It's a movie that, Alonzo, I agree with you though. Upon watching it, you're kind of like, well, I'm not sure I got it. It's a little slight, all these kind of things, and yet it sinks in.
Yeah.
It's life. It's life.
You want to talk about Araby? I know we both liked Araby.
Why don't you? Because I actually saw it a couple years ago. I think I saw it a couple years ago. It feels like I saw it a couple years ago.
It's a movie not unlike Life and Nothing More. It kind of has this quality of like non-professionals, like somebody's real life. Maybe actually that's not a real life story. That's a made up story. But I mean, like Araby is about a I'm trying to think of it. Is it Brazilian? I know the
Brazilian factory worker.
Yeah, and so you get the story of a factory worker's life, his itinerant life, going from town to town trying to find work, because a young boy finds like the diary of this worker's diary after he has an accident and has to go to the hospital at this factory. And so after the boy, at the beginning, you're with this teenage boy who's kind of like bored with life, and he lives in this factory town. He finds his diary, and then all of a sudden the movie becomes the story of the migrant worker. And it is just this beautiful look at all the ups and downs of that life. I mean, it just, once again, it has this feeling of, these stories just don't get told typically, and not with every aspect of them. Like what it's like to fall in love when you're an itinerant worker, what it's like when you just have beers with everybody and sing songs, and then maybe in this situation somebody's really cruel to you. In this situation, you're going to make jokes about who you work for.
I mean, it's also, it's not announcing its themes advance or even as it's going along. Yeah. Like, no, we're going to be looking at marginal lives.
Right.
You know, it's
but
just
then at
telling.
Least, then at the end, the wounded, broken soul comes out in this, you know, kind of very touching way that involves anger and sadness, and you just realize these lives are just so hard. It's like one of those movies about hard lives.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah. It is
and
a beautiful movie.
Very much like these other
so soulful
films that I liked so much last year, like Support the Girls and Good Luck and Western and El Septimo Dia. It's like all these films are
about work and life,
people
and
who you have to work in some rotten place for rotten people.
Support the girls and also the idea are really good like that, yeah.
Araby, by the way, is A-R-A-B-Y. Yes. It's two directors. It came out 2017. Definitely worth people finding.
Yep.
We have to wrap up, but
I
can't. I know. I could.
We haven't talked about Burning yet.
Oh, I know. Burning and Shoplifters.
My favorite movie of the year.
I did put Paddington 2 at the top of my list, and that was not a stunt. Like, I genuinely think that that is a great film.
It's so enjoyable.
It's charming.
On Twitter recently is how people are thinking that it's some sort of film critic meme where they're just saying something to be like some sort of dank meme from film critics, like, oh, we're just goofing, we don't really like this movie, we're just gonna say it out loud a million times.
Well, what it is a sincere meme. I mean, like, I didn't connect with that movie as much as some of my colleagues have, but I just find the bear creepy in the animation.
Leave this house.
Agreed. But Hugh Grant,
but everything
is
that
wonderful.
Surrounds
yeah,
him, and
yeah,
Hugh
absolutely.
Grant especially, you know, is great. You know, the but I do. I mean, I can, you know, testify to the sincerity of the critics who did connect with it. You know, it's like, and the idea, I mean, what I was, I guess, going to say, the idea that that's caught on, that it has become a meme of, like, you know, sincere celebration, I think it's because a few savvy social media types. I think David Ehrlich has been very vocal on it, and he's smart,
like,
about the way,
like,
that he communicates.
It's like an Ealing comedy again. It's like getting, like, it's just like, I miss, you
that's
know,
nice.
I mean, I just feel like there's a certain kind of comedy that I miss that isn't being done, which is like not like a, you know, aggressively R-rated, improvised, in your face. Like it is the comedy of like beautifully told farce, beautifully constructed, you know,
quotidian absurdity.
God, I know. Yeah.
And the sight gag of, like, you know, an entire prison set of uniforms being, you know, kind of like dyed pink by having something red in the laundry with them.
I imagine Wes Anderson seeing the movie and getting to that scene and being like, oh, what did I do?
Can I do three? Wes Anderson's like, can I do part three?
But yeah, no, I liked the you know, IndieWire made the effort to sort of lump that film with "Won't You Be My Neighbors?" The idea of nice core, you know, the world is such a horrible place that we need these movies that just sort of really unabashedly just like stand for niceness.
But also,
and, you know.
The flip side of that is, I did love How Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is also one of my favorite movies of the year. Completely, for the first time I feel like ever, maybe made writing look so completely unromantic and de-romanticized the writing life in a way that I just worshipped that movie.
Oh, that scene
that.
With Tom Clancy at the party.
I liked that movie just because it made irascible women
absolutely. I know, it didn't apologize. It didn't apologize for them. Didn't make them. I just love that movie.
And I'll tell you what you're saying before about, you know, the R-rated comedy. One of the things that I loved about Game Night, even though it is very much an R-rated comedy, I loved how scripted it was. I am so sick to death of the improvised, like, oh, we got these funny people, we'll put them on the set, and Holmes and Watson will be magical because they're so funny. It's like, no, write it first, script it, like, have setups and payoffs and structure and all the things you're supposed to have in a comedy, and it will be funny.
You know who's amazing at that and makes it feel improvised is Armando Iannucci. And
even
I did not love Death of Stalin. In fact, I disliked that movie.
But
I appreciate this about it. Something didn't compute about what seems like almost
love.
Like
Death of Stalin is a movie that I can tell in 10 years I'm going to love, like, so much. Like, the more I think about it, the more I love it, the more I catch it now on, it's on cable right now a lot, so I'm watching it in snippets all over again. I'm just going, oh yeah, I'm going to love this movie the more.
I feel like it's a showbiz satire, not a, like, you know, a Russian political satire.
But
and
it is
you have
total
to
history.
Like,
it's absolute. It's an absolutely historical.
It's like Preston Sturges for me.
History than Green Book is.
Right. Good point. You know.
Very, very, very true.
Before we go around the room and find out where Linoleum Knife listeners can find you, I need to say one more thing. Two awesome people in two not good movies. I can't get enough. I cannot stop thinking, and this is months and months and months ago, about Michelle Williams in I Feel Pretty, which is not a good film.
No, she's great in that.
She is so great in that.
She's magnificent.
Yes, that is a magnificent turn. Absolutely.
It's a turning point kind of performance. It's a turning point character for movies like that, I feel.
Yeah.
Hi.
And I
I wanted her to play that in Venom, too.
I was, well, speaking of Venom, I love Tom Hardy in the lobster tank in Venom. I love Tom Hardy in every moment in Venom.
He is so good in Venom.
He is doing something else that Venom isn't doing, but like... It is. He's
having a good time. I was not doing it.
I had such a blast watching him do that thing in that
me
movie.
Too.
So there you go.
Those were your two, literally.
Those
two. Okay. All right. Well, yeah. Before I run around, everybody, this is a good time to remind you, especially any new listeners who have joined us. Hey, go check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Woo!
Yeah. Because here's what's going on. We just started a new level.
Oh.
For all you people who are of the mindset like me, which is don't spend money. Or if you can, spend the cheapest amount of money.
Send cake.
I'm all about spending the cheapest amount of money. If you want to be, you know, a Linoleum Knife Patreon Club member, there is now a level for you. It's $1 month. Here's what you get for your $1 a month. We're working on these videos. We don't know if we can figure out how to do it or not, but we're working on it. But what you get is the Linoleum Knife sticker that you got if you were the $4 member last year or the $7 member last year. And you get a new thing that we're doing called LKRX. Get it? Like a prescription. Where we tell you every day on the Patreon site, exclusively for you, a cultural recommendation, and it could be a book, it can be a film, it can be a TV show, it could be the latest cupcake at Sprinkles. Whatever we decide it's going to be is what it's going to be. $1 a month. That's how you can jump in this gang.
I will pay you $1 right now.
I'm opening my wallet right now.
I know.
That's genius.
So yeah, Monday through Friday, you get a new LKRX for $1. And then above that, you get all kinds of extra content like LKTV, a podcast of the television, a Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, Linoleum Nights, where we say swears and talk about controversial topics, and also club meetings and hangouts and selector items and prizes and all kinds of great stuff. So do join.
Manola thinks she's on Linoleum Nights right now.
I know. It's only on the Linoleum Nights you can find out what the dogs do in the driveway.
And when my wife is on Knife and Fork, does she curse?
No, that's a clean show.
Oh, that's a clean
and
show.
She may, yes, yeah. Yes. But Robert is, of course, married to Margie Rockland, the spoon of Linoleum Knife and Fork. Our essential third-party expert. Anyway, y'all, this is always a treat. Thank you so much for coming.
So
thank
wonderful.
You.
Thank you.
I come away with recommendations.
I know.
Like,
Robert, do you even social, bro? What's your deal? Can anybody find you anywhere?
Yeah.
Yes.
He's
okay.
Tennis
I never court. See you tweet or whatever, so I don't know.
You can find me on Los Angeles tennis courts. And I on Twitter, I'm at R.A. Abley. My middle initial is A, so okay, I throw that in there.
Mr. Bruges?
Twitter is a place where people are mean to me based on what I feel about Marvel movies, but I am at Ask DeBruges. Send your hate my way. That's my last name.
Or your love.
He'll take
and
that too.
I write for Variety. You'll see 80 reviews from me in the next week at Sundance. Follow along.
Hello, Manola Dargis here. It's at Manola Dargis at Twitter. Do not at me. You will
Can
be
I just
muted.
Say, I have
and
to,
Instagram.
I have
oh
to
yeah,
really...
and I'm in Instagram where it's a very specific thing that I do on Instagram.
Also, Manola just
Wait,
posted
muting,
on Twitter.
Is that a thing you can do?
An
you
incredible...
can watch.
You can mute people on Twitter.
You can mute people.
You can mute
Twitter.
People anywhere.
No, and also when you
Manola's
follow
Manola
Instagram on
Twitter is. The best cat pictures.
That's true. But when you follow Manola on Instagram, you get things like she posted an incredible like clip of Elaine May at the Emmy Awards announcing the
Total Mediocrity
Award. And it's a hilarious clip and it's so appropriate
it's a
to today.
Here's the other thing you get from Manola Dargis on Twitter. Withering responses.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I am
like a knife.
Ripost.
So I'm so here for every one word response that you give.
They are the Dorothy Parker.
To every person who comes at you. I'm
the
like.
Textual side eye.
It is the Dorothy Parker no
every
view,
day.
Like every day. That's what.
Oh, man.
But
if
I try
answer,
not to be mean. I try not to be mean. That's
no,
my,
it's
okay.
not mean. I don't
it's
think
just,
Dorothy,
it's succinct,
Dorothy
exactly,
Parker
yeah.
writing no was not being mean. She was just being honest in the most distinct, cutting way.
It is terse and churse. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at LinoleumCast. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Leave us that beautiful 5-star review on iTunes.
And nothing less.
And also give us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Spotify and SoundCloud and Stitcher and Podbean and, you know, Google Play, all that stuff. And I guess that's it. Y'all have a great 2019.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll be back next week with, well, actually, I'm going to finally see Glass. We'll talk about it next week.
Goodbye.